Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Today my guest is Jody Sperling, and I know I had a Jody Sperling on earlier in one of the previous seasons, but this is a different Jody Sperling. So what happened was, when I was doing a deep dive on my previous Jody Sperling guest, I ran into information about the one that we're going to hear from today. And I reached out to the one we're going to hear from today a little more than a year ago to say, hey, I'm interested in talking to you. You seem like the kind of person who would be a perfect fit for my show. And she got back to me and said that she would reach out to me when she's ready. And I said, okay, great. And then I had the episode with the original Jody Sperling. And that was that. And Jody reached out to me last week and asked if she could come on because she has an event coming up in June that she wanted to talk about. And I said, great, that's the perfect timing because I'm trying to get the podcast going again. So let's do this. And so we scheduled it for today. Today is April 30th. That's when we're recording it. So you'll hear it a little later. You're going to hear it in May. But we recorded it Tuesday, April 30th at 10 a.m. And It's a wonderful conversation. We're talking about dance mostly and Jody's dance practice. Jody has this wonderful art practice where she is kind of re-engineering the spirit of Loie Fuller's work and integrating it with new media work to bring attention to the environmental crisis. And for those of you who don't know, Loie Fuller is a dancer from the turn of the century. There are a lot of famous films on YouTube that you can watch. I've learned today through my conversation with Jody Sperling that these famous movies, which I've been watching for years, aren't actually of Loie Fuller, but Loie Fuller impersonators. And I had no idea. She's got this one called Serpentine Dance. You can look it up on YouTube. It's amazing. Only this Serpentine Dance film, which I have it in an anthology collection of old films, which I use for inspiration. Apparently, it's not actually her. It's an imitator, which she sued for her imitations. And it's just like, oh my God, that's really interesting. So I learned something today that has sort of broken my heart, but also just kind of is interesting. And it opened my eyes to a world that I was really unaware of. You know, I had all these misconceptions about this world. And that's part of why I like doing this podcast and talking to people I previously probably wouldn't have run into otherwise. And now we have this amazing episode with this really insightful conversation. And so please join me for my conversation with Jody Sperling, the founder of Time Lapse Dance, a 501c3 nonprofit founded in 2000. Thanks, everybody, and I'll see you on the other side. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well.
Thanks for reaching out. I know it's been a while, but I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. I was just thinking, I was talking with someone, we're thinking like, what can we do to help spread the word about our program? And then she was like, oh, what about podcasts? And I was like, wait, we had that conversation with my namesake.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember finding you because I was doing a deep dive before interviewing the other Jody, and I'm like, this person sounds my speed. I'm going to just send this person an email real quick and then keep working on the other podcast. Yeah. So, but I'm glad that you reached out because I've been trying to figure out how to get my podcast going again because I've been on hiatus for a very, very long time. February, my daughter was born. And then last autumn, I went into a film production, so I had no room to do any shows. So this is like perfect timing.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. Well, congrats on your daughter.
Thank you.
That's a hard thing. Mine is 12, so we can talk about parenting and having a arts, career. Great. So, and you do that. Your podcast is audio, right? Like we're just the Zoom is just
I
for audio.
have I have YouTube, but I don't have to include the Zoom if you don't want.
No, that's fine. I just always like to know. I blurred out the background for that reason, just like if it's
Oh,
going to
okay.
be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, the first 3 years I was doing it, I had an external camera on me and it was like really high quality. And then the Zoom would be like in a box.
Yeah.
But the workflow for that was like an all day edit. So I cut out the
Got
external
it.
camera and I just go straight to YouTube. And really, the reason is because it gets more downloads than audio. Like the
Yeah.
audio, depending on the guest, sometimes the audio will do better, but most of the time YouTube just kills it. It's just,
Oh,
yeah.
great.
So
Okay.
I don't know
Well,
why.
I'll post it. I'll share it to my page also because we have a YouTube page as well. So.
Great. Yeah. And
Okay.
I think you're going to be a good guest for this show because this show, it's really about talking to people who are pursuing the art life. And that's definitely you based on the other interviews I've heard with you. And so what I'd love to do is just start with your story, unpacking how you got into dance. I know that you've told this before, but my audience hasn't heard it. So, there's an aspect to your story too that I really want to explore here is how you were kind of told, and feel free to correct me, that your weight wasn't quite right for a dancer or something like that. And you kept doing it and you kept ignoring it and it wasn't bothering you. And I love that. And but because you kept doing it. And then in your college years, you talk about taking AV classes because you wanted to integrate new media formats into what you were doing. And I'm interested in sort of the psychological profile of somebody who's thinking this far outside of the box and just ignoring all of these social cues and pursuing this anyway. And so that's the story that fascinates me. When I was doing that deep dive on the other guy, I'm like, huh, this is,
Wow,
you
you
know.
really did some serious research because I don't talk about this stuff all the time. So I'm going to give you like a good scoop here.
I'm down to listen.
Because it's interesting. I feel like weight doesn't get talked a lot in the dance world, and I feel like we've come such a long way. But when you're a little girl in the 70s, yes, growing up, that was me. You take ballet class, and at that time there was just this understanding, especially at that era of the ballet dancer as being incredibly thin and kind of to the this almost aestheticization of malnourishment, like, and people can blame Balanchine or you can blame, but it was a kind of just a social phenomenon of, really aestheticizing extreme thinness. Now, that's not to say there are some people who are really, like naturally have very slender builds and, that's lucky for, or was lucky for them, or maybe it's unlucky for them, depending on, where and when they're born. But I grew up as a child of academics and, both my and I grew up in the household, of academics, but also in a building that was like faculty housing. So pretty much every single kid that I knew growing up had parents who were professors, or and I actually just went to my grade school reunion, or artists, or ran local businesses. And I grew up in the village and in New York City. So, if you grew up in the village, you went to the Joffrey Ballet School, and I think there was something about the music and the kind of mathematics of ballet that really resonated with me aesthetically. There was something about the geometry. If you've ever taken a ballet class, you do everything front, side, back, side, and everything is kind of proportioned so it fits into a kind of rhythm. With certain music, and there's a sequence of exercises that develop in this very kind of logical way. And the ballet class itself is something that You know, there are some people who never become professional dancers who spend their whole life just devoted passionately to taking ballet class. And it's this wonderful experience, or it can be a wonderful experience in a way, and it can also be an oppressive experience in some ways. But I got captivated by the musicality, by the geometry, by the experience of movement. You know, the avenue for dance that was open to a little girl was ballet. And so I started in that training. And I did have the experience of being body shamed. You know, Jody and so and so have to lose 5 pounds by next week, you know, when you're age 10, 11. And I don't know why it didn't crush me. That's a good question. Like, why didn't it crush me? Why didn't I feel inadequate? But I think what it did is it made me think, oh, I can't possibly be a professional ballet dancer, but I can still enjoy this. And so I did it for the pure love of doing it. And as I, you know, when it got into high school, I discovered oh, I can take jazz, you know, dance. And at that time in the 80s, there were t you could just go around the city, you know, $5, $6. I would bum off my parents, and I'm gonna go take a class at Broadway Dance Center. I'm gonna go take a class here. And I literally, you know, in the summertime, so I didn't often end up going to camp, but I would just hop around two, three classes a day at different studios. And that was something that sometimes I did it with my friends. But it was something that you could do. And what I, you know, hooked into was like, wow, there's this whole world of dance happening, and there's all different ways to be a dancer. So as a, you know, academic kid, and I went to Stuyvesant High School, which is like a math science high school. It's a very competitive school, and it has my dad went there, my brother went there, and they're both scientists. You know, again, I had this idea, I'm just doing this dance thing because I love it and it's fun, but you know, probably I'm gonna, you know, go into science or some, you know, something like that. And I always cared. I was always concerned. Even then, in the 80s, I was really worried about the future of our planet. You know, because climate change was something that was starting to be talked about. Even, you know, then, like it was a big concern. And so I thought when I went to college, I went to Wesleyan, which is a wonderful liberal arts college, and I picked it because they had a dance program. But I thought, oh, you know what? I'll do the dance, but then I'll also study environmental science or you know, something like that. Well, you know, it turned out I kept doing the dance. And this is what I tell people, like if they say, like, when did you decide to be a dancer? You don't just one day decide to be a dancer. You decide one day you're going to be a dancer. And then the next day you decide you're going to be a dancer. And then the day after that you decide you're going to be a dancer. And so it becomes an everyday thing. And what happens is you look at your choices over, you know, a few years, and all of a sudden, what you know what you've decided to be a dancer every day for the last 30 years. And so I think that's like this constant kind of renewal of commitment. You realize you're a lifer. And you know, when I got to college, I you know, there was I think I might, you know, there was a it, all of a sudden I was exposed to a whole different genre of modern and postmodern dance and contact, and had to kind of learn how to, you know, there was like almost like a repudiation of like some of the, you know, the 80s jazz that I was doing, or the sort of technical ballet that I had been trained with. And it's like figuring out how to kind of integrate and incorporate all these different influences. But what I got from my education was this understanding of interdisciplinarity, so that like when you really are creative is when you're taking is when you're crossing boundaries between fields of inquiry. And I really got that in a great way from like my childhood education, and I got that in a great way in college, and you know, in my you know graduate education as well. This idea that you can pull ideas together from different disciplines and explore them in your work, and then kind of figure out how to embody them, you know, and then you really are doing something, you know, different physically than what has been seen before, but also has this very strong connection and rooting in historical process and framework.
I'm trying to figure out whether I should go back to something you said earlier or take it forward with something else. But I'm going to take it forward to the new media aspect of it, because it seems like you have a lifelong learning philosophy to everything you do, to a certain extent. Is that correct?
I think it's essential if you want to be a creative artist, you have to keep learning new skills. So yeah, I've always, like, each piece I do has to have some element of, like, both a kind of idea and a concept behind it, but also there has to be some kind of physical mastery in it for me, or some new physical exploration. So, like, just over the course of my career, I can, like, if I zoom out, you know, I can look at, you know, I got sort of interested in, you know, at different times, like, for, you know, the main genre that I do, I think if people know my work, or I'll introduce it, is that I do work that draws on or is inspired by the work of Loie Fuller. And Loie Fuller, for those of you who don't know, and increasingly many more of you are going to know, because she's more and more present in culture these days, is she was one of the most celebrated performing artists from the 1890s to the 1920s. And she created one of she was almost like a progenitor of modern dance. And she had these enormous costumes that she wore with hundreds of yards of silk. And she would put sticks inside the silk and spin them around her. And so it created kind of these sculptural moving forms that were like gigantic three-dimensional, you know, kind of forces of nature that she would conjure in a body. And then because, you know, she was an innovator in technology also, she illuminated these spiraling sculptural forms with really, you know, novel engineered lighting for her day. And so, you know, this was such a, like, incredibly influential art form. And she was so, like, powerfully present in culture from the 1890s to the 1920s. And then she became sort of forgotten for a while. So I got interested in her kind of, like, happenstance-wise. I know this is a long detour, but I got interested in her happenstance-wise, like, by, you know, pure chance in the late 90s. Someone kind of, like, introduced me to the form, and I started to experiment and play with it. And there was this incredible technical challenge of, you know, having been a kind of modern, postmodern dancer where I did a lot of floor work, and I was, like, you know, connecting to the ground and maybe climbing on other people. So all of a sudden having this enormous silk costume with sticks inside it and sort of manipulating and creating this larger than life three-dimensional form. So for me, what happened was that was, like, one technical challenge, like the physicality of how do you inhabit this apparatus. It's like a costume, but it's more than a costume, right? And so that became a kind of, that's been kind of the center of my creative work for the last 25 or so years. But I've always, even within that, like, I got interested at various times in some of the, like, if I go back to the, like, early aughts, I guess that's what people say now, I was interested in that idea of spectacle. And so I sort of learned, like, I studied contortion because I was kind of interested in, like, what the kinds of, like, tricks that people, that women would do to, like, please and impress. And so there's a kind of, like, undercurrent of, you know, feminism in those pieces. And we studied, you know, contortion, partner acrobatics. I got really good at hooping or hula hooping. And then I started doing aerial work. And I was interested. I did a few pieces on a trapeze. And so I was like, each one of these pieces became like what kind of, like, kept me in it physically was this challenge of it. And then the, you know, continuing to develop the Loie Fuller piece. And so now I, you know, I was sort of feeling like, you know, as I'm, you know, in my 50s and I'm, you know, I feel myself changing. And, you know, after having had all these kind of, like, intensely physical experiences, I was looking for what's that next thing? What, how can I continue to like grow and enhance integrate some new experience into my work? And the last two summers, I did an underwater dance workshop with a company called Project Limb. And I had this experience of learning some breath control to be able to hold my breath and to dance underwater and to experience this weightlessness. And the workshop integrated some free diving techniques. You know, I got to be a very, like elementary level at it, but it still was like incredible experience. And so the next work that we're just like poised to develop is going to be drawing on that experience that I had of being immersed and experience the kind of anti-gravity sensation, and also what it is to like dance without breathing. Because I think, you know, that's a thing that you're always taught is, you know, any dance teacher in the world will be like, breathe, breathe. You know, it's like no dance teacher ever has told you, don't breathe. And so I actually, it's a, like one of the ways that we practice for the workshop was actually on land practicing not breathing. And it was like, it's such an interesting counterintuitive experience. So that's just an example of how I think for me, every new work that I do has like some, has to have, integrate some new kind of physical, technical challenge to kind of keep it interesting along with the kind of conceptual core of the piece and, you know, like what we're trying to accomplish. You know.
What drew you to wanting to take an AV class in college? So you, because as I know you did this too, and this is what also stood out to me is this openness to look at these new media formats like Hi8 at the time and integrate them into whatever you were doing. Because I've met a lot of performance artists who don't bother with any of that stuff. And I'm interested in and why you were attracted to that.
That's so interesting because I sometimes forget, like, you know, like when you've had a, you know, live for a while, you sometimes forget like certain things that happen earlier in your life. And then you realize there's this like track and the track is very consistent, at least in, you know, like I've had like pretty similar interests my whole life. Like I've always been interested in dance and I've also been interested in how it's captured on the screen. And when I was, yeah, I just was, I had, you know, I always loved movie musicals when I was growing up because they were really big. And I just thought that was only the kind of, that was really the only kind of dancing that you saw. And also like the 70s, 80s was like, you know, there was Fosse and, you know, like remember seeing All That Jazz, which is this like crazy, like dance, like extravaganza of a movie. And so it just seemed like, well, wow, if you're interested in making dances and choreographing dances, like film is like a logical thing. And Wesleyan has this incredible film department, but you know, they shoot on film. Yeah. And they only let, you know, the very famous woman in the film world who runs this program, but they only let film majors like take that class, you know, intro to production class. So the only class they had on campus was this like taught by the AV guy. You know? And so it was like, he's the guy who would wheel the TVs around to the, you know, to the different classrooms. So they had a few super VHS camcorders, and we went out to the cemetery by the campus and we did some dancing around. And I was interested in like, you know, the frame, like going in and out of the frame. And we forget that in the 80s, oh, the other kind of thing that was out there at the time was this, there was a TV show called Alive from Off Center. You think there was a lot of avant-garde stuff happening in the 80s, like, and MTV, this is like a really interesting kind of just aside about like media technology performance. So MTV started when I was, you know, like in junior high or the equivalent of that, right? And a lot of the sort of early music videos borrowed from the sort of avant-garde you know, performance artists of the time. And there were sort of these, like Laurie Anderson is a good example of like a crossover, you know, artist, but she was the host of this TV show called Alive from Off Center. And they showed video dance on this, you know, and I remember seeing, I don't remember, it was in the 80s, I saw Philippe de Coufflé did this piece called Codex. If you haven't seen it, you got to see it. It's incredible. And there just was a lot of like amazing video art, video dance done in the 80s. And so I was sort of, I had been exposed to it just by turning on my TV, you know? And so I was interested in, you know, like just with a smattering of ideas, like what can I do? And then I was given as a gift, I had a camcorder, a Hi8 camcorder. And so after college, I made money by videotaping people's dance performances because not everyone had a video on, you know, on their phone at that time. And it's so sad now because I think like I was like lugging this stuff around and it was like I was videotaping people's performances. And, you know, now you can have a much higher quality image. And it's like there's so many years that we did stuff where there's very little like record. We didn't, you know, of what we did. And now my daughter can't do anything without, you know, shooting it. It's like it didn't happen, you know. So that's sort of why I was, you know, I think their video dance was a thing. And then I ended up writing my undergraduate thesis about video and dance, kind of doing like a cultural studies perspective on the difference between screen dance and stage dance. And then I was very lucky. Merce Cunningham came to Wesleyan with his filmmaker at the time, Elliot Kaplan, and they screened this latest project he did called Points in Space. And I got to interview Elliot Kaplan for my, you know, senior thesis. And so I just was like interested in screen dance. And I haven't, even though I have ended up, you know, I think that served me really well when I, on later projects, because I was choreographer for the feature film, The Dancer, or La Danseuse, which is a sort of biopic about Loie Fuller. So just having a kind of real background in video kind of production and sort of understanding how the camera works helped me, you know, choreograph the piece and also communicate with the director and the crew. I'm also, you know, subject in a Loie Fuller documentary. And again, I feel like it helped in those, you know, in that communication component. And I do, during the pandemic, when we had to go virtual, I did, you know, start to, you know, produce some dance films and, you know, very low production values, but it's amazing what you can do with, you know, I think I had an iPhone 6 at the time. And, you know, I did a couple of films. You can see them on, I know this video is going to be on YouTube. So you could see one of my, some of the films that we did on YouTube, on our YouTube channel. One is called Single Use, which I shot during the pandemic. And it was just me in my plastic bag suit rolling around on these empty streets. And the camera person, or we called her the DP, is a time-lapse dance board member, Angela Hunter. And she's, you know, normally a news producer. So she, you know, had like, was excellent to collaborate with on the fly.
Well, I can, after we are done here, just, I'm going to email you to send me, a picture as well as all the links you want to share, and I can share your YouTube links.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And
I mean, the main thing I want to just, you know, we have this program coming up, which I'm really excited about. So I'd love to, you know.
Yeah. I figured towards the latter part of this, we can go into that, and I'll let you take as much time as you want. I'm just trying to paint the story of you for now.
Yeah. Okay.
Fire away. So let's talk about your Arctic project. That's interesting. That's like the dream, right? I have this fantasy of spending a winter at Antarctic Station and just writing.
They have, don't they have, you can apply, right, for the writing fellowship.
Yeah, my wife's not gonna let me do it though.
Okay. Well, not if you have like a little
Yeah,
kid.
exactly. She's got to grow up a little
Well,
bit.
one day. Well, one day,
Yeah.
you know what? It'll be warm down there, and so you can go sit, you can
Very soon it'll be warm.
you can summer down there.
It's like depression humor.
Sorry.
It's okay. It's pretty funny.
Oh, the question, my Arctic trip. So, okay, so let's rewind. So here I am. I've been making these pieces using this Loie Fuller costuming, which is oodles and oodles of white silk, right? And I get really interested in this idea as we're working with these costumes about how they expand you into space and they connect you with the environment in a way that's so palpable. Like you're just literally bigger than life, right? And I also was very interested in this idea is like when you move through space, that you know, without the costume, you're actually you can't see it, but you're creating a whole kind of aerodynamic you know, impact in the space that's invisible to you, right? But you move through air and there's a wake behind you and you're creating eddies and you know, spiraling, you know, little, which, that's what an eddy is, a spiraling kind of current in the air every single time you move, and it's completely invisible. But the fabric with this, you know, if you have oodles and oodles of silk, they essentially kind of visualize this way that you have an impact on the space. And so that was one of the reasons I got really interested and kept working with this Loie Fuller apparatus from. You know, through over the decades, because I just feel like there's been this way that it continues to be interesting visually, kinetically, and can help me tell stories about humans in nature and or humans and elemental forces. So I was interested in doing a project about the Arctic or in relation to the Arctic because I'm thinking my medium is white silk. Like, what's a better way to represent, you know, like snow and ice and Arctic formations than white silk, right? You just, you know, it's a natural fit. So I had this idea, and then I reached out to a scientist who Larry Pratt, who's at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and he had gotten in touch with me a few years ago previously because he's an oceanographer who studies turbulence, and I had done a piece called Turbulence. And Larry is really interested in dance, and so we just started this correspondence. And he actually even used some of my footage of my dances to kind of demonstrate properties of turbulence. And so I went to go see Larry at Woods Hole, and he introduced me to his colleague, Dr. Robert Pickard, or Bob. As we called him. And Bob in just, you know, is a renowned Arctic scientist. And he invited me to come with him on one of his cruises. And I was like, what is that? And it was basically a 6-week scientific mission to the Chukchi Sea, which is an area north of the north of Alaska on the US in US waters. And so I, you know, you think like, how could you turn down an opportunity like that? Well, at first I did turn down that opportunity because I at the time my daughter was 2 and I thought there's no way I could be away from her for that long. But I came to my senses and we worked things out and I went and it was really a life-changing experience and a pivotal experience in the development of my work and aesthetics as well. And so I went to the Arctic, got on a ship with 50 scientists and 100 Coast Guard crew, and became part of the team. I was there as a member of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, or HUI, outreach team. And I was there as a researcher, as an artistic researcher, and to communicate about the science that was being done. And so I got to go out on the ice when there were ice stations. That's like when the icebreaker would sort of nestle up to a floe, and they would put down the these sort of a ramp, and we'd go down, and the Coast Guard would make sure that the ice was thick enough and solid enough, and that there weren't any polar bears around. And then, the ice scientists would set up their stations where they would drill. And then I would set up a little station where I would, improvise and set up a camera. And this is where all my video experience really came in handy, because I had to figure out how, I couldn't bring my audience to the Arctic. So I had to figure out how to capture what I was doing. And so over the 6 weeks, I got to go out on the ice 12 times. And I learned about how to move on the ice, how to kind of tolerate the cold. And I drafted different members of the science party and the crew into helping me shoot it. And we made a short film called Ice Flow that was edited, shot, produced on board. And then I also did workshops with the dance workshops with the science party and the crew, and gave lectures and attended lectures and just learned a lot about Arctic science, and even participated in some of the data collection, which really I found fascinating. So it was really a life-changing event, and helped sort of focus my art around climate change and around climate engagement, and also helped me understand how dance can be how you can really, the research for the projects that we do can involve scientific research as well as creative exploration, and how a dance work could bring these elements together. So yeah, when I came back from the Arctic, I made a piece called Ice Cycle. And what it did was it really visualized and set into embodied motion the experience of sea ice and its different transformations. And I had learned about sea ice, and it's a very interesting and fragile and also very dynamic phenomena, and very endangered, and very important for the kind of planetary like climate system. And so this was the piece, Ice Cycle, is like a homage to sea ice.
Well, can we talk about your process for adapting Loie Fuller's work into what you're doing? For example, I'm very familiar with her Serpentine film. I think that's probably mm-hmm. her most famous one. And so are you looking at these films to figure out what she's doing, or are there other records that you can go into? And also, from just a costuming standpoint, what sort of research, what does that research even look like?
Yeah, so that's evolved over many, many years. But I will say, like, when I first started off, I did a lot of historical research. I went into the archives and looked at the court documents of her copyright infringement suit, where she, sued her imitators and basically describes what she was doing. And I spent a lot of time looking, at newspaper articles and reviews and reading all the published materials about her. But looking at the pictures, and that served to kind of create like maybe the first garments that I was using. But after that I really have very little interest in doing historical reenactments, almost none at all. because I'm basically taking you, once you have the costume, what you're doing is you're just making a dance using this apparatus. Now it's a tribute to Loie Fuller because it's really growing and expanding her idiom. But I'm not doing, there's no record, there's no direct lineage of people. Like, it's not like Loie's students kept her dances alive you know, generation from generation to generation, the way that Isadora Duncan had, there's a direct, you could learn the exact dances that Isadora Duncan did because she taught them to her students and those students taught them to their students. And you can now, there's a lineage and, you know, the two different, you know, threads of the lineages, they might disagree on how they're done and they might disagree on, you know, who's the better interpreter, but there's a direct connection with the ancestor. With Loie Fuller, I'm lucky that this like chain was broken and I get to completely reinvent what's happening. And so I'm not going to say that it's like that it's not influenced by her, but like I might have, you know, for instance, with the underlighting effect, which we used, I don't know, in a piece, you know, about 2006, so almost 20 years ago, we started using this. We had a box and we had some underlighting effect. And it's like, I'm not saying that I wasn't influenced by having seen the Serpentine films or having done this historical research, but I wasn't in the studio looking, oh, she used red and then she used blue. Or it's like we were making a piece from scratch using these tools. And that freedom enables you to do something that's interesting with it today. And so, as I mentioned earlier, like one of my major like interests, concerns, things that I want to communicate about is climate change, right? Like that is like the fundamental, like, you know, thing that every single person on the planet is like facing and or in denial about, right? But it's the thing that's going to influence their life the most. And how you respond to it, how you deal with this enormous thing that seems like overwhelming and difficult, or, you know, too huge, you know, or not my fault, or, oh no, it's not happening, or whatever it is, how you deal with it, that defines who, you know, you as a person in this time. And I feel like I wanted to figure out, it wasn't even I want to figure out somehow. It's like if you're an accountant, right, and you care about climate change, you can cost how much it's, you know, sea level rise is going to, you know, cost your community, right? You could do that. If you're a lawyer, maybe you can represent like, you know, an environmental group like that's being attacked by a major corporation, right? Or and if you're an artist, like you're thinking, OK, well, how can I help people, you know, with the Arctic piece? It's like, how can I communicate how imperiled and important sea ice is? Like, how can I bring these conversations? People are afraid to talk about climate change because it seems too scary. How can I start conversations like around climate change? So for me, it's like, I started off, okay, with that first piece of bringing Loie into the Arctic. I had the costume painted with a pattern of sea ice that is sea ice information in the exact same spot where I was dancing. And so the costume, when it was in motion, it was able to represent, without even me really planning this, but it ended up representing a kind of time lapse of the ice. And so what I realized, I had already named my dance company Time Lapse Dance because I was thinking about this continuity between past, present, and future and how there are these trajectories that we're on. But what I realized is that a dance can be like a time lapse of the elements. And everybody's fascinated by time lapses. You know, people search like time lapse clouds. People love to watch time lapse clouds or time lapses of the stars, you know, like passing through the night sky, right? Or time lapses of the eclipse or time, whatever it is. So I'm like thinking, okay, this Loie Fuller costume, by connecting the dots of the motion, expanding what you do, we can create time lapses of natural phenomena like ice melting, ice drifting, ice in formation. That's one thing. Another piece that we've done is windrows. And this is one of our, you know, core pieces. So it's windrows. We can create a kind of time lapse of clouds, you know, rumbling through into a storm. Or, you know, we do other things with the Loie apparatus in that piece, which is to literally stir up the air and let you feel the wind and the disturbance if you're sitting close enough and you can hear it by how we move the costumes. And then this piece that we've done, Arbor, we had trees painted onto the costumes. And so with Arbor, what we're doing is we're kind of representing the, you know, time lapses of tree motion and tree growth and tree conversation, you know, and the ways that they connect. But we're also doing more because it's also about understanding how trees model this interconnectedness and like multi-species singularity and multiplicity all at the same time that can really be a model for humans and how humans can connect, communicate, relate to one another in a peaceful way. So, and that, yes, we're using the Loewy-Fuller apparatus to do this, and we're using the Loewy-Fuller apparatus in conversation with nature and ecology.
So the project that is earmarked for June?
So that is, the evening is called Sound Earth Motion, and it's an integration of music, dance that focuses on nature and our relationship with nature. And I talked a little bit just now about Windrose, which is a piece that I created in collaboration with composer Matthew Bertner. And Matthew is what is called an eco-acoustician, which is a way of saying, or he's been very influential in the field of eco-acoustics, which is a kind of way of relating sound and environment. So he uses natural systems in his music composition. He does recordings, but he also thinks about what is the sound structure in the environment and how can he represent those structures into a music composition that would be played live in performance. And so I've been collaborating with Matthew since Ice Cycle, which is the piece that we developed after my Arctic trip. So it's been 10 years, really excited. For this program, we're going to be presenting two major collaborations. One is Windrose, about atmospheric change and the way that wind is changing along with the climate, but also about tuning into a sensory experience of air. And then the newer piece that I'm thrilled to be sharing, and which we've only performed one time in New York previously, is Arbor. And this piece is about trees, but it's about the ways that humans and trees are alike, and that we share this way that we are both one and multiple at the same time. And that if we start, you know, we think about trees, one tree as being a single entity, right? But since Suzanne Samar's groundwork research, into tree ecology, they've realized that trees actually communicate with one another underground. You may have heard of the phenomenon of the wood wide web, right? That there are these underground networks of tree roots, and there are mycorrhizal fungi, little kind of that connect the tree roots to one another, and they can send signals, they can share nutrients with one another, and that it's this collaboration between fungi and bacteria and plant life that allows a single organism, like such as a tree, to thrive, but really can't separate where one tree, you know, begins and ends and where a forest happens. And so life is so much more complex, more interconnected than we think. And the same is true for people. We really overemphasize individuality in our, especially in American culture. And I think that part of the problem of climate change is having too fixed a boundary between ourselves and the world. And if we break down that boundary and we understand we're not separate from nature, we are part of nature. Nature is not something out there. Nature is in us. And we're also not really one being. We're like trillions of beings that are kind of collaborating to create this illusion of a single self, right? Or a unified ego, but really we're in and amongst ourselves, we're collectives, and that we operate, you can't have an individual human without a community, right? And so I think that we really, in this moment of peril for our planet, we really need to come together in person and experience the ways in which we are a collective and how we can act in a collective, and we can take action collectively. And that's what Arbor is really about. It's about this experience of, as I said, multiplicity and singularity in trees and in humans, and just seeing these parallels and opening our minds to that idea. I'm really excited to share it. So we have this program, and in terms of the music, this is like fantastic. Matthew's created an incredible score, and it draws, some of the research we did was me visiting him in Alaska, where he's from, and kind of literally playing with his trees and him recording the sound of me moving the trees gently. No trees were harmed in the making of this score. And then he has transposed some of the elements onto a string quartet, and it will be played live by musicians from the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra and at this event. And the hall has just incredible acoustics. So we're doing Windrose, Arbor, and then I will be offering a reprisal of one of my early solos, also with live music performed by an incredible pianist, Jeffrey Middleton. And it's really like it's an homage to Loie Fuller, to Debussy's Clair de Lune. And I'm doing it partly because of the recent eclipse. I feel like we've all been thinking about our place in the universe. And this piece is really about just experiencing that sublime, reverence for the moon.
So where should people experience this? Call to action.
So to find out about information, tickets, please visit our website, which is timelapsedance.com. You can go to the events page and you'll see it's a performance, and there's also a wonderful gala and reception afterwards. So if you enjoy the performance, if you want to meet us, talk to us, have a drink with us, then buy a gala ticket, support the company, and just have a fabulous time with the artists and with other Time Lapse Dance fans and special guests. And also, I just want to say that this is all happening because of an ongoing eco artist residency that I and the company have at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. They have been providing us a home for rehearsals and performances, and also collaborating with us, because our goal as a dance company is to make the world a better place, more sustainable, more equitable through dance. And the goal of New York Society for Ethical Culture is to make the world a better place, through action. And so I can't think of, for me, dance is action, right? And it brings people together. So our missions are very aligned. They've been opening their home to me as resident artist for the last 2 years. And we have many more plans in the works. So I really encourage you to come to their gorgeous historical home on Central Park West and 64th Street in the Upper West Side, and experience this sublime space, and to also get to meet the other ethical folks that are there. I've been challenged to really think about what is ethical dance making look like? What are ethical practices, in every aspect of what we do? And it's been going back to your earlier question about, continual learning. I have just learned so much in the last 2 years about really opening myself up to the possibility of making every choice an ethical one. And it's a constant and ongoing challenge.
That's great. And it's an interesting connection too, is because my wife went to the ethical culture school growing up. All the way through their high school. They have a high school in the Bronx as well.
Fieldston, wonderful. Yeah. So your wife grew up in the city. So I went to the Village Community School, which is, I think, a similar kind of philosophy. Yeah. So your wife knows the space very well. It's basically the auditorium, but the school and the society are separate entities, separate organizations, but proximal.
Yeah. Yeah. She explained it all at one point years ago, and then it just. But
where are you
yeah,
based
I love
now?
that. Moved to Maine in August, but we are looking at over the next year splitting our time more. I love that you I love that the lawsuit was instrumental in you understanding what she was doing. I think that's hysterical.
Well, it's really funny because the lawsuit was against an imitator and she had to describe what it was, and I literally went to the library at the time, and I'm photocopying the pages from the lawsuit. Is the law library I'm in, and then I'm like reading it, and I was like, wait, I'm like literally at the photocopier thinking, I could do that. She's like, make the shape of the half umbrella, and then do a rose falling to pieces. And so to this day, we use the word half umbrella when you bring the right arm up and then the left arm, and it's an alternating movement. We call that the half umbrella because how Loewy described it,
So I actually will. Can I use that part? Are we back on the record? Okay. I want to actually explain to the audience that those, because I didn't know that those films weren't her. So are there no films of her?
So, fun fact. There are actually no films of Loewy Fuller herself, but what's interesting is she was so popular and so widely imitated that all the films that purport to be Loewy Fuller or of Serpentine dancers are actually Loewy Fuller imitators or followers of her style. And it's not widely known because a lot of museums will use these films. And they will, list them in the catalog as being Loewy Fuller. But that was just because whoever published them, in 1890s, early 1900s, they just published it and said it was Loewy Fuller, but it's not her. And once you know what she looks like, and you study the historical record, and you can easily identify her. And there's some question about why she never was filmed. And I think most people who are in this small Loewy Fuller, scholar arena think that, the technology of film at the day was pretty primitive and it really couldn't capture the incredibly luminescent, colorful kind of three-dimensional spectacle. And so the films are kind of paltry in comparison. It's also possible she didn't want to create a commercial product that might, cut into her ticket sales. So, it's hard to know. She did become a filmmaker and created a film called Life of the Lily or The Lily of Life, which she created based on a script of Queen Marie of Romania. And so she was an experimental filmmaker, but she didn't published Serpentine Dances, but just like one further note about this is that many of the earliest color films were of Loewy Fuller imitators or so-called Serpentine dancers, and what they were is each frame was hand colored to represent the sort of kaleidoscopic effect that Loewy got with stage lighting. But if you look at the even though they're quite lovely and beautiful, they're never going to be as richly sort of hued as a live performance would have been, because Loewy used dozens of lights of different colors angled from all over the stage, and so you really had a tapestry of color in performance, and it was constantly changing. And if even frame by frame painting two or three different colors in one frame, you're not going to get that sort of multiplicity of effect that she got in the live performance.
I've learned something today. I appreciate it. Because that film is an anthology that I keep around, along with A Trip to the Moon and some other ones. And it's strictly for when I'm commissioned to use to do a music video, I'll watch all of them, and that's one of them, just for like inspiration. And so I'm just like, my world is shattered. Yeah, I had a talking point on here about, because you had mentioned you had done corporate gigs on another podcast, and I thought that was like, most people wouldn't think that that's a thing a dancer would be hired to do, is a corporate gig, but that's really interesting. And but I never tackled the talking point.
Well, actually, a lot, this isn't really a talking point, but just like a lot of, like dancers, their bread and butter work used to be car shows, like back in the day. And I remember talking, or there was like much more crossover between the worlds of like avant-garde and commercial work for the performers. And now we have this sort of, you know, nonprofit world and a profit world, and Broadway's somewhere, you know, like it's in the profit realm, but maybe there's like some crossover between nonprofit theater and Broadway, and because it's a nonprofit passion to develop projects, right? But yeah, so we, you know, special events, like, and even, you know, all performers do special events, birthday parties and whatnot. So we've done some corporate gigs. That is like, I wouldn't say it's bread and butter because it's pretty infrequent, but it's, those gigs are so great when they come, because, you know, to there's nothing like for an artist, you know, to feel like, you know, if I hire a dancer to do it, they just get to feel, you know, just to make real money for change is amazing.
Yeah. Well, I again, I really appreciate you reaching out to me. I've been trying to figure out how to integrate big, epic, Busby Berkeley level dance sequences into my work for years, but I was never networked with the right people. And this past project that I did, I had, since these communities were really open to it, I told the actors, look, I don't care if you know how to dance or not, but we got to have an epic dance sequence where you're dancing on all four of these different islands. And we filmed it over the course of a month, where members of the community would come out and we would just move from island to island, filming the different islanders dancing with them. And since we didn't have a dance coordinator, I was just like, just look like you're having fun and have fun.
Right.
And if you're not having fun, that's a problem and it'll come through. And it was one of my favorite things to film ever. And then eventually when we got to one of the islands, that's probably more popular amongst, you know, the people from the real world, we actually found somebody who's a dance teacher there, and she's like, well, can I coordinate our island's dance sequences for you? And I'm like, yeah, yes, please. Absolutely. And yeah, you could tell like that she and her students were just moving so elegantly. And I'm like, oh, this is what we needed on all four of these islands.
Right.
Even though everybody looked like they were having fun, like, this is what like woke me up to it. There's a difference. And so on the next one, I'm definitely going to reach out to more people and be like, here's what we're doing, and help.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, yeah, if it seems appropriate, like a kind of project, like I'm definitely open to these kind of like gigs, these kind of gigs, like film or, yeah, film.
I mean, we had them dancing on like an old weapon battery from World War II that's been abandoned. Cool. Yeah, it was really cool. And on the ferry system, the ferries.
Is that like music videos or?
It was it's part of the film. It's just part of the film. It's still in progress, but it's called 43 Degrees North.
And is it a fiction film or is it a documentary? Yeah,
it's fiction. It's just, I tend to go into these art house tangents. And so at the end of the movie, I'm just like, we're going to have an epic dance sequence for no reason. And you're going to love it. And it's going to be that.
That sounds very Bollywood.
I like Bollywood.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I'm glad we connected.
Cool. Yeah. Well, good luck with that. Yeah. All right. Take care.
Thank you. Enjoy your afternoon.
You too. Bye-bye. Bye.
And that was my conversation with Jody Sperling. I hope you enjoyed it, and I will see you on the next one. Thanks, everybody.